This is the Stamfords podcast at the Stamfords Travel Writers Festival at Destinations in Olympia.
Put your hands together and welcome Chris Stewart and Paul Blessard, everyone. How cool does he look? Come and sit down, sir.
Thank you, Zoe. Thank you very much indeed. And thank you to you for coming here. Are you enjoying the travel show? Booked your holiday? Found somewhere interesting to go? Who's going to Spain? Who's been to Spain in their lives? Pretty much everybody. Slightly more embarrassing question. Who's read any of Chris's books? Driving Over Lawrence? Okay, it's the home crowd.
Driving Over Lawrence.
This is your audience. For those of you who maybe don't know, Chris had an interesting career, which we won't talk about, but he was the original drummer for Genesis. He was then a shepherd in Sweden, did all sorts of things, and then found a place in Spain, a farmhouse on the wrong side of the mountain. So what I think we should perhaps start at, given this is the travel show, most of us go to a place, visit it, buy a souvenir, have a coffee, leave, come home. You went to a place and stayed there, and I kind of want to know what it's like when you start to dig down into the community. What's the difference of living in a place rather than just visiting it is the big question, I suppose.
Thank you, Paul. That's a great question. And it's great to be here. But I think before I answer the question, I'd like to point out that I said I would like somebody to be in conversation with, because it's a lot easier that way. You don't have to think of what to say. And when I arrived, they said, no, there's nobody for you to be in conversation with. You're going to be in conversation with yourself. And then Paul turned up. And he's a person I know from previous experience is very difficult to shut up. So I shall try and sneak the odd word in edgeways and say it like it is, tell it like it is. Well, I guess, you know, I used to do a lot of travelling, and travelling always seemed to me, the reason for travelling was to find somewhere to settle, was to find somewhere really good to stay and live. And 26 years ago, I happened to find that place. And therefore, for me, travelling is now a bit of an irrelevance, actually. I can travel at home alone as I will. And I found it tremendously rewarding. 26 years living where we live, becoming a part of the local culture in a big way, steeped in the language, steeped in the culture, steeped in just the way of life and everything that goes on around us, to the extent that it's something I recommend to everybody to do round about the middle of the road of life, is to up sticks and go and abandon your home culture, your native land, and go and live somewhere else and become a part of it. Because what it does is it stimulates you constantly in so many ways, but in particular in the language. It's language that really gets me going. The very fact of going out, going shopping, doing a simple thing like going shopping in Spanish. And I speak tolerable good Spanish, as you'd expect after 26 years. But it's an adventure. It's an achievement. And the feeling you get when you craft a really classy sentence, one that sort of rhymes and scans nicely in a foreign language, is just really unforgettable, unbeatable. It's pretty good in English. You know how nice it is to craft a good sentence in English, Paul.
I do.
You do. Indeed, you do.
Was there another question?
I'm looking at you thinking, is there another question? Or is that it?
Well, hey, there is another question. The question is this.
Yes.
Talk us... it is a decision when you decide, okay, I found a place, I kind of want to live here, and you wrote about it, let's go back to Driving Over Lemons, about the difficulties of leaving the culture that you have been brought up in, that you grow up in, to take on the mantle of another culture, to be accepted by them. When did you start to feel accepted by the locals in near Valdea?
Okay, that's a sort of rider to what I just suggested, that you should all leave England and go and live somewhere exotic, because you need to have some sort of context in which to go in order to feel a part of the community, to be accepted, to be able to get your feet deep down into it. And before we left England, we were farmers. We didn't have a farm, but we had a flock of sheep. So we knew about farming. And the place where we went to live, which is the Alpujarras in south of Granada, there were a lot of sheep there, and it was a very agricultural area. So everybody we met and all our neighbors knew what made us tick. They knew how we made our living. We had a subject in common. We were never stuck for something to talk about. And little by little, as a consequence of this, we've developed a very esoteric vocabulary, closed to all but the agricultural Spanish. And so I think I first felt a part of it when I started working in the area, when I became a sheep shearer. I mean, we have our own farm. We have oranges and olives and almonds and apricots and sheep. And so the work on the farm is constant. But actually to go out on the road and do work locally where you are seen and either accepted or not as a member of the local community, that was the big moment when I started going around and shearing sheep. And I became, el guiri pelador de ovejas, the foreign sheep shearer. And that was a great, it was a great sort of notoriety.
Quite.
I really enjoyed it. And I also had the distinction of being the first person to shear sheep in the Alpujarras with an electric machine. Before that, it was all done with hand shears, and it was a wretched affair, not enjoyed either by the sheep or by the shearers. And I had my critics. People came to me, mostly foreigners, who would come to me and say, well, here you come here and ride roughshod over local traditions and introduce this infernal new technology. Well, within 3 years of my being there, all the shepherds in the Alpujarra were shearing with electric machines. It's very much easier, very much kinder on the sheep. And I felt this is it. It was a bit like being a sort of a great god fallen from the pineapple tree and being able to institute a new technology in this primitive area in which we'd gone to live. And that was the beginning of it, I guess. That's what really set me up.
That's when you realised you could make a living here, you could bring your family up here, you could become a part of it.
Yeah.
Rather than being stuck to the side of it. One of the things that comes across from all three of the books, and in fact the most recent one as well, is this fantastic switch between triumph and disaster that you have that's part and parcel of an agricultural lifestyle of running a farm. You are subject to the weather, you're subject to crops, you're subject to the animals. But talk us through some of the great trials, some of the things you're most proud of having achieved over the 26 years that you've been there.
Oh, that's a nice question and a good one because someone gave it to me the other night, so I know the answer. You'll be pleased to hear. My books, and there are five of them now, believe it or not, a proper oeuvre, but they are really a catalogue of failures and inadequacies. And I just discovered that that's a sort of persona that I should project if I want to sell books. People like that stuff. People don't like books about people who are absolutely wonderful about it, wonderful at everything they do. Everything works out right for them. They like people to be. And so what I am is a sort of amiable buffoon, a professional amiable buffoon, and that's okay with me. You know, I can live with that. But you've got to be careful because if it is just one long catalogue of disasters after another, it gets tedious. So you have to intersperse them with your triumphs. And I'm trying to remember a triumph now. Somebody said to me, he said, you know, well, given all these awful failures and the way things have gone wrong for you over and over again, is there any one thing that you're proud of as a consequence of your move to Spain, your life in general, something you're proud of in your life? And I had to think a lot about that one. I'm sort of proud of writing the books. Writing the books was great because I wasn't brought up as a writer. I wasn't educated as a writer, like most writers, of course. I've been through the grill, which is just reading, voracious reading through most of my life, and then I finally set pen to paper in the very twilight of life at the age of about 45, I think I was when I did it, and. So, when Driving Over Lemons, my first book, came out and started selling and started pouring out of the bookshops, well, that was pretty exciting. And, well, my mum was certainly very proud of me.
That's always a good judge.
It was the biggest day of her life. As for me, well, I think just the fact of having survived, really, the fact of having survived 26 years in quite difficult circumstances, we left a very comfortable, secure, pleasant life in England, but unchallenging. And we wanted things to be a little bit harder, just a bit more exciting. And that's why we up sticks and dumped everything, and without thinking it very well, went to live in the wilds of Andalusia on a remote farm, abandoned for a very good reason, way up in the mountains. And many have tried this stunt. Many have pulled it as a consequence of having read my books. And many have failed, I know. I get a lot of letters from people who say, well, you know, thank you very much indeed for suggesting this crazy idea to me and my wife. You know, we fell out 3 years ago, and we're never going to speak to each other again. We had to sell the farm at a loss.
Oh, dear.
But it worked for us, and I think there's... That says, you know, this may be my good quality, perseverance.
Are there any times, I mean, when you put yourself into those situations, you think you want a challenge, and then the challenges come, and it's possible that people think, well, what the hell am I doing here? I've made a terrible mistake. Have you come close to giving up at any stage? Have you thought, what the hell am I doing when the dogs have gone missing the other side of a flooded, engorged river, or your daughter can't get home, or the crops fail, or you're just too remote and there's no Wi-Fi and you haven't got any food in the fridge, all these things?
All these things happen, and they all happened. And one way or another, we came through. And I think the main reason that I was able to get through, we never did think of giving up, ever. Right. There were times when a little bit of despair crept in, when the work was too hard and there seemed to be no reason to keep doing it at all. And when we came in the evenings, we were too exhausted even to read or to think or to talk. And we feared that we were turning into peasants in the pejorative connotation of that word. Anyway, we didn't turn into peasants. We still read and we still talk and have conversations. But I think what sustained me all the way through it all was the wife, Anna, who is my muse. So the single essential element for pulling a stunt like this is the correct choice of a partner. Now, of course, that cannot be done by you alone, because you are the last person to be able to view objectively and intelligently the choice of a partner for the rest of your life. So in my case, it was an arranged marriage. Now, I know arranged marriages are very unfashionable these days, but it was arranged by my sister. And my wife was a friend of hers, and she figured that she'd be a good woman for me. And I was therefore manipulated into her direction. And, well, we've been together for 40 years now, under very difficult circumstances.
Has she ever nearly given up?
Oh, constantly, yes. Well, I think perhaps I'm not the same inspiration. I couldn't hope to be the same inspiration to her as she is to me. So this is a sort of paean in praise of my wife, who's also my muse, Anna. So in fact, what's the name of that guy who wrote the books about horse racing? Dick Francis. Dick Francis, a colossal seller.
Whose wife Mary wrote allegedly some of the books, or some of the passages in the books.
You've stolen my punchline, Paul.
Sorry.
I look a little uncomfortable because every time I lean back, it pulls the microphone up towards my eyes. I'm not speaking with my eyes today. Yeah.
There you go, a bit more room.
Yeah. It's age, it's the vicissitudes of age. Mary Francis actually wrote all his books. He didn't write them at all, but he was a very good front man, and she didn't fancy going out in public, which is what you've got to do when you write a book nowadays. And so, but anyway, Dick Francis's fans don't mind at all, I don't think. But I'm similar. I did write these books, but I only wrote them down at the dictation of my wife. She's my muse, my inspiration. She's a better observer of humanity than I am. And it's her stories, and it's the way she tells the stories when she comes home after a day's work that it inspires me, and that's what made the books. And she says that, you know, everybody in the world wants to be a writer. It's a pretty nice way to make a living, actually, if it goes well. Except her. She's not remotely interested in it, so I do the writing, and she does the talking and the observing and the telling of stories, and it works very well.
For those that haven't read Driving Over Levens yet or any of the other books, give us a sense of place. Where is this farm situated? What do you have there? Paint the picture for us. Take us on a mind travel.
Mind travel, right. Okay, well, what we have is a big farm. We have a 70-hectare farm, which we bought for the magnificent sum of 25,000 quid, which wouldn't have bought you a garden shed in Sussex in those days, 25 years ago. It's 70 hectares, but most of it is really rough, steep grazing land that grows thyme and rosemary I've forgotten the botanical name, but it doesn't matter.
Sage.
There's sage up there too. Tremendous diverse botany and a lot of rocks and steepness and dust and thorns, and it's a place for the sheep to go and graze. And at the bottom of this, we have a couple of hectares of irrigated land, which is green and shot with flowers in spring, and it has orange trees, which require weekly irrigation through the summer, and olive trees. And surrounding us, we have nothing but mountains and rivers. We cannot see another house from where we live. And there's not a street lamp for 20 miles. And so we have a wonderful night sky. And I think that these are privileges really beyond counting. In Europe today, to have a bit of land where you look out only on the beauty of rivers and mountains with no other houses in sight, and you can see an uncluttered night sky, and you have orange trees from which you can go and pick oranges to make your orange juice for breakfast every morning. You've got lemon trees, and we've just taken in the olive harvest for this year. Now we have our own olive oil, which is the most, that in itself would make it worth living in a place like this. You know, it's not great olive oil. It's not the super extra double virgin first cold press single estate, single variety thing that people go for these days. It's a lot of green, cloudy muck with a lot of sheep turds in it. But it tastes like nothing on earth, as you can imagine. And these are the privileges. People left. The reason we bought this place so cheap is because nobody wants to live in these places anymore. You can't make a living out of them. Agribusiness has won the day. Nobody can live off small mountain farms. And the work is very, very hard. The returns are paltry. But the return we get for really working pretty hard all the days of the week and all the months of the year, the return we get is an extraordinary quality of life, a really privileged quality of life, mainly in the quality of our orange juice and our vegetables and our olive oil, the peace and to be surrounded by beauty. You think that's not asking a lot, but in this world of today where we seem capable of creating so much ugliness, it's quite a privilege to have found that. And what was the question, Paul? I've forgotten.
No idea, but I was enjoying the journey.
I was painting a mind picture of it, wasn't it? Yeah. And we live in a very primitive house. It's a little less primitive now. When we arrived there, we had 6 years without a telephone. Imagine the blessing. We wrote letters to people. This is long before the internet. We wrote letters to people. People wrote us letters. We've kept those letters all those years. You wouldn't keep an email for 26 years and feel it and enjoy the handwriting. I'm talking like a dinosaur here, I know, but it's true. Then the telephone came in about 20 years ago. And after the telephone came high-speed broadband internet, which is extraordinary, way out in the countryside. We have solar power, so we're entirely self-sufficient in power. We have solar panels, and for those rare, rare days when the sun doesn't shine, we have a generator that we turn on. But that's not many days in a year, I can assure you. We do have the most blessed climate in the world, about 345 days of sunshine a year.
And are you on mains water, or do you water from the well or the river?
I hesitate to say that it's better than that. We have a spring.
You have a spring.
Yeah, we have spring water pipe to our house. Hot water comes from gas. I've been constructing a solar water heating system out of old beer cans and bicycle tires. But the prototype is still a long way off coming out in public yet, so we still have to buy gas to heat our water. But everything else is more or less produced on the place. We're not self-sufficient. Everybody says, hey, do you make your own goat's cheese? Well, we haven't got any goats for a start. Why did you keep bees and make honey? Why do you make yogurt? And all this stuff. And we think, well, you know, what we do takes us more or less 24 hours a day anyway. Just the growing of vegetables, the harvesting of fruit, the looking after the chickens and the sheep and so on and so forth. We want a little bit of free time as well. We're just a little bit more demanding than the country people who lived in places like this were before, who would live entirely off their own produce. It was subsistence farming. And in broad bean time, people would eat broad beans for breakfast, for lunch, and for supper, and think they were very lucky to do so. When my mother first came to stay with us, my mother is a most delicate woman from Billingshurst in Sussex, She was appalled at this diet that we gave her of broad beans for breakfast. No woman from Billingshurst has ever eaten broad beans for breakfast before. We were just making a point. But anyway, now things are a little bit better now. We don't make our own wine. We buy a better wine from the north of Spain, what the locals call those Catalan wines. And we don't make our own candles or anything like that. We don't make our own petrol for the car. We have a car. So we live a sort of a comfortable life. The only heating we have is a fireplace. Yeah. And we produce all our own firewood from pruning of the olive trees and the almond trees. And so it's just physical work that gives it to us. And that's all the heat. And so I feel, as a consequence of this, that we have really become a part of the place that we initially traveled to and traveled through, thinking, would this be a nice place to live? Now, for 26 years, we have drunk its water. We have been shaded by its trees. We have been warmed by its wood. We have eaten of its earth. We've eaten the eggs that are produced by the chickens that pluck the insects from the air in it. So I feel we've become so much a part of this that we're almost like the earth. And the only way that we will ever leave there is in a box, obviously. And I'm very much in favor of green burials. So I have made for myself an esparto coffin.
What's an esparto coffin?
Esparto is a sort of a wild grass, a very wiry wild grass that grows in the Mediterranean. And it is above 1,000 feet. And they used to make everything with it. They used to make ropes, baskets and panniers and harnesses for horses, buckets. Everything was made out of esparto. It was the plastic or the bakelite of the poor. And it grows wild all over the place, but people don't use it anymore because there's rubber and there's plastic and there's all these other modern materials. And it's a hellish job going up onto the hillside on a baking August day to pluck esparto grass. And then you weave it into long, long ropes. And this is what I've done. I've woven it into long, long ropes, and I've made a frame, and it's a double coffin for me and the wife. And in it, it has a little bookshelf and a little compartment for keeping wine bottles. And I've dug a hole on the mandarin terrace beneath a mandarin tree. And there the coffin lies, and Annie, my wife, and I go down, and we fool around in the coffin for a couple of hours every afternoon in order to get used to the big sleep. That is the only way we will leave the place. England's lovely. I love this country. And it's wonderful to come back and visit it. But it never sort of fulfilled the urge for adventure that I had.
Right.
And yeah, life is adventurous still. And
it should be.
It is. And it's a great way to live. It really is. I recommend it.
Okay, so that's a sense of the place. That's where you are. Tell us what the average working day, if there is such a thing, is. How early do you start? What needs to be done? Because running a small holding, running any agricultural business, is really hard work.
Oh, I can tell you about it, Paul. Anyway, the advantage of having solar power is you don't get up before light in the morning, before first light. And I've never been an early riser. I've been a farmer for most of my life, but not a sort of getting up early in the morning type farmer, if you know what I mean. I've never had cows to milk. I draw the line at milking animals, which is why we have sheep. Sheep are like dogs and cats. They sort of mold to their keeper's ways, really. So when I get in a bit of a panic some mornings and it's 10 o'clock by the time I get into the sheep stable to let them out, I find they're all still in bed as well. That's the advantage of sheep. So anyway, I get up at usually about 8 o'clock most of the year, which is a reasonable time, and there's enough light to not have to turn any lights on and waste the power. Obviously, I take the wife a cup of tea in bed. If you've got a muse, you've got to treat her right.
Mm-hmm.
And then I go out and I feed the chickens. And if you haven't got chickens, then really I'm at a loss to know how you begin your day. It's become so deeply imbued in me, the business of feeding chickens to get things on the move, that I can't imagine starting a day without them. So that's
most people go to Starbucks and have a latte, but do you also have a different one? You don't have a Starbucks locally.
We don't have a Starbucks, no. We couldn't even go to town. It's too far to go to town for a coffee. So we have really good coffee at home. But I'm one of these people, I like to work for a couple of hours before breakfast. So I feed the chickens. It doesn't take very long to feed the chickens. We've only got half a dozen chickens. There's only two of us living in this place now. We brought up a small family, and she's gone, and it's just the two of us. That's what the last book is about, incidentally. Yep. It's about two old crazies living on a hill with a handful of chickens and some lazy sheep. So I feed the chickens. And then I take the dogs for a walk. And I take the dogs. We have three dogs, and I feel it's part of the social contract you sign with dogs, is that if you want them to do right, you take them for a walk every day. So every day I walk up the river. And the river is like our own wildlife reserve. There's nobody there. Nobody lives anywhere up there. So I got a couple of miles walking up the river in complete peace and silence with the three dogs. And there are ibex up there. And there are occasionally, once I saw a black stork. And there are wild boar. And there's just, and there are fish in the river. And it is just the most magical experience. You must think, what a bore to walk up the same river every single day. But every single day it's different. The way the spring starts and the shoots come up and little by little things start to flower and the trees come in leaf. It is the most rewarding experience. And I take the dogs about an hour and a half up the river and then I bathe in an icy pool, which is apparently terrific for the testosterone, for those waning testosterone levels. Ice cold water for 20 minutes every morning. Note it down, Paul.
Thank you. And noted.
Then I saunter home, and as I come up through the farm, I pick three oranges, which is what you need for a glass of orange juice. Mm-hmm. And then I make my breakfast, and I linger over breakfast a little bit. And then, say, at this time of year, I'll go out and I'll prune. It's pruning time. Because almonds are just coming into blossom now. Now is a great time to visit the Alpujarra. Because it's at its most beautiful, because it's just clad in clouds of almond blossom. One of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. Wow. Orange blossom's pretty nice, and cherry blossom's pretty nice, but almond blossom is what has it. And in fact, funnily enough, I'm taking almond blossom appreciation walks this spring. So if anybody fancies signing up for that, there we will be. The almonds need prune. The almonds, you prune them a little bit earlier on, because they're blossoming now, and you don't want to lose all that blossom. But now is the time for pruning the olives. So, you know, we're days and days and days up in the olive trees with pruning hooks and chainsaws, cutting them. And the beauty of it is that olives, I don't know if you ever tasted an olive fresh from a tree. It is the bitterest, bitterest fruit you could possibly imagine. It's only after long soaking and steeping in desirable flavors that it becomes acceptable. The leaves are similar. If you bite an olive leaf, it's bitter as you can like. As you can imagine. But the sheep love them, and they're very nourishing for the sheep. So we prune the olive trees, and we throw the branches to the sheep, who eat the olives and the leaves, and produce lambs, which we eat in our turn. And then, when they've eaten all the leaves off them, we chop them up and leave them till the next year when they become firewood. I mean, it's all just so perfect and wonderful. And there's a lot of awful stuff here, too, but I'm not going to tell you that. I'll just tell you the better pieces. And then I come in for lunch. And I make lunch. I do the cooking because I just happen to love cooking. And my muse is too busy thinking about things and observing things to do the cooking. Anyway. So we have salad for lunch in the winter because there's a lot of salad vegetables growing in the garden. She runs the garden. She does all the gardening and growing. And lunch, a siesta. A siesta is the most important thing of all.
After breakfast,
lunch and tea. Yes. Now, the siesta is very important. A siesta is a most wonderful institution, and one that's looked at rather askance here in Britain, I think. Mm-hmm. But the thing about a siesta is that if you're having a good day, if it's a nice day, with a siesta you wake up twice to the same day, so you get twice the life, twice the pleasure. It's also very good for you, and just really pleasant.
Sounds marvellous.
And if it's hot, then you've got to, you know, you can't work all after through the heat of the afternoon.
Tell us a little bit about this latest book, The Last Days of the Bus Club, because, of course, for most of the 26 years that you've been talking about, there have been three of you in this wonderful situation with your daughter. However, things have subsequently changed. She's gone to university, and it is just the two of you. That's a major difference, I would imagine.
It's a big, big difference. Have you been through this?
No.
No? Do you have children?
Yes.
It'll happen one day. It happens to all of us, and nobody tells you about it. the books that I've written are more or less, or the books about the Alpuxarra, sort of follow the trajectory of Chloe, my daughter. She was born in the first book. The second book is her childhood. The third one is her adolescence. And this one, the fourth one, Last Days of the Bus Club, is her absence. She's gone. And people don't tell you about this. They don't tell you how hard it is when your kid goes away or your kids go away. And you need to evolve strategies for dealing with this problem. And that's what we're doing. We're these two lonely old crazies up there on the hill now on our own. Chloe went off to university and she did 5 years at university in Granada. And now she's off to China. And, you know, we see very little of her. We have a good relationship and that's fine. And we feel we've done our stuff now. We feel we're sort of spent husks. Withered and clinging to this hillside, but very, very happy, funnily enough.
I think you're being hard on yourself. You don't look spent to me. Can you give us a little bit of an insight? Because Spain, as we know, we keep hearing through the media here that Spain, along with Portugal, along with Greece, has had a hideous time since the subprime crisis, the credit crunch. And how that has affected you over the last 8 years, and the Spanish, the indigenous Spanish who live locally to you, who are already having a hard time. Have you noticed it up in your mountain?
Oh, you can't help but notice it. Clearly, it doesn't affect it. It's, you know, these things, particularly in Greece, they seem to be urban. You know, they have much more effect in urban areas than they do in the countryside. You know, it's always better. I'm a great admirer of country life. I think that urban life is what you do if you can't live in the countryside, although I'm sure there's a lot of people here who would disagree with that. It's the same in Spain. You know, the real bad effects are in the cities. And in the cities, it is absolutely desperate. There are literally millions living on food banks.
Yeah.
In the countryside, we don't notice it at all. And there may even be positive consequences of it. A lot of people from the cities are coming back to farm hitherto unviable patches of land because it's a lot better just growing it, being able to grow your own tomatoes than it is, you know, living off handouts in the city. So we live surrounded by an awful lot of abandoned land. I mean, this is the case throughout Europe. Small-scale agriculture has been dying as a consequence of agribusiness and just the way things are. And there is visible, definitely visible now, a sign of revival, a sign of land that's been abandoned for years is being cultivated again. That trees that were just dying from lack of attention are coming back to life again. And that pleases me so much because, to me, the beauty of a landscape is in the sort of counterpoint between the wilderness and the farming, particularly in the Alpuxarra, which is really wild land. We have some of the highest mountains in Europe, 3,450 meters, Mulhacén, and it's wild, rocky land with thorns and dust. And then you come down and there are these villages, and around the villages, they're particularly beautiful villages because they're flat-roofed houses, which is unique in Europe. They look like the Berber villages of the Atlas in Morocco and Algeria. And around each of these villages is a sort of skirts of green, of beautifully tended fields with little irrigation channels lacing them, with beautifully built stone walls, with the trees cared for. You'd think you're on the plains of paradise. I mean, it is so gorgeous. But little by little, in the last 25 years, the people in these villages don't want to farm anymore because there's no money in it. And because it's not viewed as a dignified occupation to be a farmer. So everybody's gone off to be computer consultants or everybody's joined the building boom. And so little by little, these beautiful villages with their set in their skirts of green, they've all dried up and they've lost much of their beauty. And now, as a consequence of the economic crisis, things are starting to be brought back to life again. And that really, that pleases me.
Good.
I dare say we'll come out of this economic crisis one way or another.
Hopefully, at some stage.
Yeah. And things, I won't go into a political rant now. I think it would be inappropriate. This is a travel show, for heaven's sake.
Well, it is a travel show. And a lot of people here would have come here, seen the stalls, booked holidays, and may do something similar to what you did 26 years ago. Be driving from the hotel to the airport or up in the mountains or wherever, see a little rundown property and think, oh, wouldn't it be lovely? Oh, wouldn't it be lovely to buy this and make a home here, make a life here? after nearly a quarter of a century having done that, what would your advice to them be? Is there a singular piece of advice you could offer people that attempted?
Yes, I suppose, yeah, that's a great question and a great observation. Of course, that's what one... Everybody does that. It wasn't just me who did that when I was traveling. Everybody does that. You always look at a place with a view to think, what would it be like to live here, to be amongst these people or to be one of these people? Well, and the first and rather sort of banal piece of advice is don't buy it. Live there for a year and see all the seasons. Find out, you know, through a year's drinking in bars, just what these people are really like. You could make a hideous mistake, and I know a lot of people who did make hideous mistakes. So rent somewhere. There's always someone who's going to rent you somewhere to live, much, much cheaper, and then you can really assess it. We didn't do that. We just bought. We fell in. We jumped in with both feet, and it was the best thing we ever did. But we deserved for everything to go wrong for us. But it didn't. It stayed. So that's the banal piece of advice. The second less banal piece of advice is just do it. Get out there and do it, because it's a great thing to do round about the middle of the journey of life.
Quite.
Up sticks and go and
throw it all up.
Wallow in another culture.
Yeah. Quite. Quite.
I would think so.
And you still as pro-Spanish as you ever were?
Still?
Pro-Spanish culture?
Oh, very much, yeah. I there are wonderful people to live amongst.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have their faults, but hey, so do we.
So do we. Indeed.
Let's not go there.
We have a couple of roving mics, or at least one of them. No, we have two. It's time, if you want to pitch your questions to Chris, who would like to kick us off and ask on anything, whether the act of writing about the experiences he's had or the having of them to begin with. Who'd like to start us off? Does anybody have a question? Does nobody have a question? Ah, well, we have two in a row. Gentleman there and then the gentleman here. Thank you.
Nice and close. Nice and close. Nice and close. Okay. Hello, Mr. Stewart. Do you think your beautifully described account of where you live is in any way coloured by the fact that your bank balance is probably a little healthier now than it was 10 years ago?
You've laid me on the line with that one, haven't you? I see. You know, I will sort of adapt the question a little bit and wonder if we would still have been living there in the same circumstances had we not enjoyed the success of the books. And I think the answer is yes. We definitely would have done without question, because even without the padding that the books have provided, and, you know, I'd be foolish to deny that they have made life very much more comfortable and pleasant, I still wouldn't have wanted to leave there, not for anything. But it's put us into this, what I consider to be a very enviable position, which is to be able to make a living in the countryside, but not of the countryside. So though, in a sense, I make a living by writing about things in the country from the books, I don't have to sell my produce. I don't have to sort of keep my feed bills down and not feed my animals enough in order to make my sales profitable. And I know what a desperate state that British small and medium-sized farmers are as a consequence of the sort of big industries, agribusiness and supermarkets fixing the prices and screwing them down to the floor. And I know how heartbreaking that is because, well, I've been a farmer for many years and I know how tough it can be. And although, you know, I would love to be I would always love to be a farmer. I'm pretty glad that I'm the sort of farmer who doesn't have to make a living out of his farm. And don't say I'm a gentleman farmer, because I don't think I'd quite fit that bill. But thank you. It's a good question. And life would have been really hard because then, without the books, we would have had to make a living out of the farm. And that would have been really difficult. So thank you.
Good question. Nice answer. Gentleman here at the front. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I'm curious as to whether you describe yourself as a writer who does a bit of farming or a farmer who does a bit of writing. And a second subsidiary question. Quite a lot of people who've been on this stage over the last few days have done television. I'm not aware that you've done a great deal of television, although I remember in one of your books you did talk about a brief visit from Rick Stein.
Ah, yes.
Is it because you've got a good face for radio, do you think?
That's what they say. Yes, I've got a great face for radio. I don't have a television myself. So I'm rather reluctant to go upon other people's televisions. It would seem wrong. Although There is talk, and we've sold the rights to the book to a television company that are making a six-part television series of Driving Ever Lemons. Imagine that.
A British TV.
Yes, a British TV. It's called...
Congratulations.
Whistling Thorn Films. I'm rather hoping to play myself, but I don't think they want that to happen.
So it would be a dramatisation of Driving Ever Lemons.
If by that you mean it would have absolutely nothing to do with the book, then yes, that's the way it'll be.
Right.
And I know what the score is, because, no, we did go into the film options a bit, and we fell in with a film company. Everybody does that. You can't help it. Yes, I was. Yeah, I did the Rick Stein thing, and I sort of felt afterwards that, yes, I do have a good face for radio, and it might have been better to stay out of that medium. But I've forgotten the first part of your question now.
Writer who farms, or a farmer who writes.
Right. Well, as a general, it's taken me a long time because, as I stated earlier, I think I didn't come to writing until the very twilight of life. I was 45 years old when I first lifted pen and put it to paper, and ever up until then, and still ever since, I've always made a living out of manual work. So it seems to me that if you don't get your hands dirty, it's not proper work. So I've always been a little reluctant or hesitant to describe myself as a writer. But when I'm amongst farmers, I do describe myself as a writer. And when I'm amongst writers, I describe myself as a farmer. That way, everybody thinks you're much more interesting than you really are. That's the way it works.
Here's a horrible question.
But if there is
a dramatization, who would you like to see playing you?
Well,
if it can't be you.
You see, it's no good. It doesn't work, that question, with me, Paul, because as a consequence of not having had a television for 40 years, I'm a real weirdo. I have no idea what anybody looks like or behaves like on the screen.
You and I both.
I could tell you who I'd like to play me on the radio.
Who's that?
Johnny Morris.
I'm not sure that's any longer possible, unfortunately.
I can't really think of anybody
else. I think
we
lost Johnny some years ago.
It is a crap question. Go on, ask me the one about Genesis. That's another crap question.
What was it like playing with Genesis before they were Genesis?
Oh, it's pretty good.
Jolly good. Are you still in touch with Collins and Mike Rutherford and the rest of them?
In sort of tenuous touch.
Oh, you were boyhood friends. You were schoolboys together at Charterhouse, weren't you?
Yeah, we're schoolmates.
Do you still play? Do you listen to music? You started to learn flamenco guitar when you were in Spain, if memory serves.
Started to learn? How dare you? I've been playing guitar for 45 years.
Yeah, jolly good. How's it going?
Well, crap, actually. the deal is, you get a gift. You get one extraordinary gift in this life.
Yeah.
And that gift can be anything. It could be singing. It could be music. It could be painting. It can be cooking. It could be caring. It can be healing. It could be loving. Could be writing. The crap part of the deal is you don't get the gift you want. I wanted to be a musician. I wanted to be a rock musician, and I'm a real crap musician. As I say, after 45 years, my guitar playing is still very indifferent. Well, it's quite dazzling, actually, but in a quiet way, you know. But what I got was to be a writer, and as I say, I didn't learn how to be a writer. It just came upon me. And again, I hesitate to blow my own trumpet, but hell, someone's got to do it. It would seem that I must be getting something right, because I've sold quite a few books over the years.
You're a very good writer.
It's a nice gift.
And it's a good gift to have.
It's not
my
bad.
Gift is for making a tit of myself, which I think I've done really well here today.
Paul, there is nobody does it better than you.
Nobody does it better than me.
What I mean, you know what I mean.
We have to wrap up there. Chris will be in Stanford signing books around the corner there. If you haven't yet read Driving Over Lemons, the first of the books, I commend it to you. If you have and you've read everything else, then now read The Last Days of the Bus Club, which is extremely good. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for coming. But thank you to this man, Chris Stewart, all the way from Spain. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
We'll be blogging and posting recordings of all the events live each day, so check back for more.